Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is another edition of Was He or Wasn't He? Where I argue both sides of the equation as to whether a famous person was a pedophile. I mentioned Britney yesterday, and I meant to actually talk briefly about it, but I just wrote the little note in the thing. And I did talk about it with the Canadians this morning, and so I'll post that tomorrow morning. And I will definitely talk about Britney, because even from when I talked this morning, there's new news comes out and stuff like that. So Sunday, probably, instead of Gossip Galore, it's probably just going to be a lot of Britney, maybe some other Gossip Galore, but everything that I have, everything that I know, everything that I found out, I'll talk about on Sunday. Mark Twain. Now, this is very interesting because of a legacy that we just want him to be this guy who walked around dressed in white and told stories and things like that. And it's a guy who died such a long time ago, but his first biographer, way back in 1912, who had access to all the papers, decided, hey, we're just going to keep most of the bad stuff a secret. And then his surviving daughter, Clara, said, I think that's a good idea. And it wasn't until her deathbed that she said, okay, people can come look at this stuff. And that's when we found out these questionable things that Mark Twain did. But way back in 2007, there was something on the Antiques Roadshow. And I'm going to give you their version of it, which is a very sanitized PBS kind of thing. And then it'll get a lot darker. At the Baltimore Antiques Roadshow in June 2007, a guest named Susan arrived with a beautiful enamel lapel pin, a black and white photo of her grandmother as a young girl, and a family story that connected her grandmother to one of America's greatest writers, Samuel Clemens, a.k.a. Mark Twain. My understanding has been that she was given this pin by Mark Twain, Susan said. Samuel Clemens, in his older years, had a group of young ladies that he corresponded with and who visited him at his home. The story is true, and the woman's grandmother was Dorothy Sturgis, one of the dozen or so young girls between the ages of 11 and 16 that Clemens, whose pen name was Mark Twain, befriended in his later years, a connection he would describe at the time as his, quote, chief occupation and delight. The group served as a girls' literary and arts club, with Twain as its focal point. In April 1908, Clemens met the first of the girls in this group, a 14-year-old named Dorothy Buttes, that's not necessarily true, whose mother insisted on meeting Clemens when they traveled to America. I'm going to tell you later that there were some in America before there were some in Bermuda. Afterwards, the author described the girl as simple, sincere, frank, and straightforward, and called the meeting a fortunate day, a golden day, and my heart has never been empty of grandchildren since. Crazy as he already had grandchildren. In the winter of 1908, on a trip to Bermuda, Clemens met about a half dozen more girls, including Sturgis, and after he got home, he came up with the idea of creating a group of young girls who he would visit and correspond with, the Bermudian Angelfish, Clemens wrote in an autobiographical dictation in April 1908. With its splendid blue decorations, it is easily the most beautiful fish that swims, I think. So I thought I would call my 10 pets angelfishes, and their club, the aquarium. Many of the letters from the group, such as the copied one that turned up at the roadshow, reside in Columbia University's Rare Books and Manuscripts Library. Befriending these girls was an antidote to the dark times that plagued Clemens during his last years. His most famous works, including Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer, were about children, and he had loved the youth of his daughters, Susie, Clara, and Jean Clemens, often inventing games, stories, and plays for their entertainment. But as his daughters grew older, his relations with them grew more complicated. After his beloved wife, Olivia, died in 1904, the family fell apart. A few weeks later, his daughter, Clara, suffered a nervous breakdown and entered a sanitarium. Clemens' relations with her and Jean, his surviving daughters, became strained. His daughter, Susie, died from spinal meningitis in 1896. During this period, he described himself as washing about in a forlorn sea of banquets and speechmaking. It was in this period that he started wearing his white suits because light-colored clothing, he said, enlivens the spirit. So too did the girls of his aquarium club. And in all, he would exchange about 300 letters with them during the 5 years before his death in 1910. Hamlin Hill, author of God's Fool, a biography of Twain's last 10 years, described them as long, chatty, childlike letters. Okay. Hamlin Hill was the first guy to really kind of go after the legacy of Mark Twain. I think it was in 1990, 1991. There had been a few books in between 1912 and 1991, but not very many. But Hamlin Hill's the one who had access to these letters. And yes, he described them as long, chatty, childlike letters, but he also described some other things too. One of the letters collected in Mark Twain's aquarium by John Cooley is from Clemens to a Dorothy Quick. I tried to get some elephants for your birthday. Okay. John Cooley also had some really awful things to say. It's nice that PBS is just skipping those. In one to Sturgis, dated August 3rd, 1908, he writes, "You will be very welcome in September, and your journey from Boston will not be a heavy one. I enclose a photo made a few days ago. The cat is Tammany, the pride of the place. You will notice that I have become extraordinarily hump-shouldered. The doctors say it will never diminish, but will increase. They say it's due to bad circulation, lack of exercise, and excessive smoking. I do not care. It's a good shape, and I like it." 100 correspondences he sent out in 1908 were to the angelfish, and in practically every letter he pleaded for a visit. He encouraged many of the girls in writing and the arts, and after Sturgis visited in September of 1908, Clemens encouraged her to compose a sign to burglars who had robbed Clemens's home shortly before the visit. "There is nothing but plated ware in this house now and henceforth," Sturgis wrote in the sign. "You will find it in that brass thing in the dining room over in the corner by the basket of kittens. If you want the basket, put the kittens in the brass thing. Do not make a noise. It disturbs the family. Please close the door when you go away." By the end of 1908, though, Clemens' enthusiasm for the club began to wane. His letters grew fewer, and he no longer pleaded for visits. Only 25 letters from 1909 survive. The tone of the letters changed, and Clemens griped about his health more, often pleaded with them to stop growing up. He cut off contact with one girl when she turned 16, and also complained about their boyfriends. In part, the change of mood had to do with the trouble at home, as his daughter Clara accused Clemens' secretary and business manager of stealing money, and he fired them. Now, there's a little side note to that. Clara made up the whole thing about them embezzling and stealing money. And the reason is that the secretary, Clara, was very afraid that Mark Twain would marry her, and then Clara wouldn't get the inheritance, because Clara at this point was the only heir. By fall, the Angelfish girls were back in school. Another blow to Clemens was the sudden death of his daughter Jean, who drowned during an epileptic fit in the bathtub on Christmas Eve. He was so devastated that he didn't make the trip to Elmira to bury her next to her sister and mother. And by the way, another little side note, they had this maid, an Irish maid, and she ended up having to discover the body of every single child, except for Clara, and the mom, Olivia. Clemens' last reference to one of the angelfish was made on a ship, returning from a visit to Bermuda in 1910, in which he wrote that one girl, Helen Allen, should protect the diamond of her innocence and be cautious, watchful, and wary. A week later, on April 21st, he died at the Clemens family home, Stormfield. The name Clara had given the house, his thinking, is more appropriate than innocence at home. Clara named it Stormfield because, first of all, she hated her dad at that point. She hated Samuel Clemens. She loved Mark Twain. Clara had actually tried to kill the family. Well, she threatened to kill him multiple times. And that might be, I did not know about the sanitarium thing until I read the Antiques Roadshow thing. But she did talk about it in letters to her friend that she had threatened to kill the family because she had this musical career and she felt like her dad didn't support it enough, although he paid for everything and the lessons and people to be with her and stuff like that. And they went through long periods of not talking to each other, but Clara always had to go back because dad was paying the bills. But it was Clara who put a stop to all of this, which is why he stopped writing. And that's why Clara changed the name from Innocence at Home to Stormfield. Now, most readers of Mark Twain know that Samuel Clemens and family lived during the 1870s and 1880s in a 19-room mansion in Hartford, Connecticut. And Clemens called it the loveliest home there ever was. And he got it because, as biographers have noted, Mark Twain kind of married really, really well. Olivia was extremely wealthy. And Clara spent her childhood and adolescence there with the older Susie and the younger Jean. The Clemens' first child was a son, Langdon, born in late 1870, but he died 18 months later. And so you had this vision in this house. They had Christmases overseen by Samuel Clemens, dressed as Santa. They had 7 full-time servants, new novels and stories that Clemens would read aloud in the evenings, theatrical performances that Clara and her sisters put on. And these remembrances, this perfect little picture, kind of belied how difficult their childhood were. So Susie was the golden child. Clara and Jean lived in her shadow. At 13, Susie penned a biography of her dad, which Clemens actually included in his autobiography. But this is how people thought that he was at home. Really nice and playful and fair. But he wasn't. Clara's biographer wrote that the daughters were afraid to be alone with him. His fits of irritation with their accompanying fireworks terrified the impressionable young girls and made them wonder how a person could be sweet one minute and a demon the next. Even Clemens, in a letter to William Dean Howells, wrote, "I found that all their lives my children have been afraid of me, have stood all their days in uneasy dread of my sharp tongue and uncertain temper. All the concentrated griefs of 50 years seemed colorless by the side of that pathetic revelation." I mean, he was away from home more than half the time. He was a horrible business person, but spent a lot of money on these businesses. And one of the other things that he did, much like with the angelfish, is that he kept tabs on his daughters as each one neared 18 and would focus on their romances and stuff like that. And Clemens tried to keep his adult daughters like, I don't know, like his infants. He wanted to bind them to their childhoods. He didn't want them to move on out of childhood, kind of thing. He wanted the adoration that they gave him when he was young. So did he have innocent things with these other girls, these angelfish, because he wanted to relive that? And like I said, Hamlin Hill was the first in 1991. Then there was a guy named Gary Scharnhorst, who wrote The Life of Mark Twain, the early years, 1835 to 1871. I think he's written some other installments. And it's an 18-chapter book, but it's from the early years, 1835 to 1871. Okay, so it's not about the whole 1908 stuff. And he talks about the death of Samuel Clemens' father, which he speculated was caused by syphilis. And then he says, "The circumstantial evidence is substantial and almost incontrovertible that Clemens was a latent pedophile with prepubescent lasses, although he admits that no solid evidence of any actual improper behavior towards young girls has ever surfaced." Then he also supported the story that the pen name derived from Sam's drinking with 2 marks being made toward his bar tabs was the reason we came up with Twain, and discounted the argument from Kevin McDonald that the name was taken from Clemens' reading of a magazine. And then he also said that Samuel Clemens' sexual habits and the possibility that he, like his father, had also contracted a venereal disease. Now, I mean, the social media of the day in the 19th century was local reporters, right? They would write anything. Nevada and California. And they would bait each other in hoax and bully and character assassinations. And that's the thing, right? So they would talk about people that were, oh, this person's an alcoholic or this person's got VD. And the theory was that a sexually active Samuel Clemens contracted a venereal disease because the San Francisco Bulletin scolded Clemens for coming from the Chinatown district. And apparently there was no good reason back then for a white male to frequent Chinatown except to patronize a bar or brothel. So did Samuel Clemens have a venereal disease? It's circumstantial. But he talks about it in the book several times. Especially when Clemens would talk about suffering from ailments and things like that. Now, here's the interesting thing. It wasn't until 1908, supposedly, that Clemens trademarked his pseudonym. So he licensed and protected the pen name as private property. It had been unprotected since 1863 when he first signed an article Mark Twain. Other people say that he had already done that. But the trademark is from 1908. And after he lost Susie and Livy, which is his wife Olivia, he would take on the character of Mark Twain. That's what he liked to do. He had that white hair. He washed it every day with laundry soap. Now, what about the pen name? Was Mark Twain? See, there was a magazine back in the day that called Vanity Fair. It's not the same one. And MacDonald published this theory that Samuel Clemens found the name Mark Twain as a character, as a cartoon character in a sketch in Vanity Fair. And that's when he comes from, and that's where he sticks to that theory. But there was another theory that it said the bar tab story was not real, that it was told by a Nevada journalist for entertainment purposes. It was basically in January 26, 1861 issue of Vanity Fair, there was a character named Mark Twain. And this Kevin MacDonald, he's a book dealer in Austin, Texas, and he writes in the Mark Twain Journal all the time. And he was searching Google Books for unknown pieces of Twain's writing. And one of the hits led to a mention of Mark Twain in the humor journal Vanity Fair. And that was one of Mark Twain's earlier influences. But it was there 2 years before he adopted. So it was 1861, and he started using it in 1863. And it's a sketch, a burlesque titled The North Star, and it talks about these meetings between Charleston mariners who adopt a resolution abolishing the use of the magnetic needle because of its constancy to the North, because this is 1861, right? The Civil War. And the characters included a Mr. Pine Knot, Lee Scupper, and Mark Twain, which is a shallow depth in shipboard jargon. And MacDonald said he wasn't looking for it, he just stumbled across it. And Samuel Clemens actually worked as a reporter in 1863 in the American West, and that's where Vanity Fair was. Everybody agrees that he read it. And it was in Virginia City, Nevada, when he was there. It was in every newspaper in California, Nevada during his time there. The first known use of Mark Twain as a name came in a letter that Samuel Clemens sent to the editor of a Virginia City newspaper. As opposed to his other pseudonyms, which he had others, Thomas Jefferson Snodgrass, it stuck. Now, Clemens used to say, "Where did you get it from?" And he came up with some kind of theory that, you know, it was from a guy that he stole it from, like a New Orleans captain. So that it was a captain named Isaiah Sellers who also went by the pseudonym Mark Twain, and Samuel Clemens said he stole it from him, but obviously he didn't. But Twain also used the pen names Josh, as in just joshing, and John Snook, as in to snooker. There is no Mark Twain in any of the New Orleans newspapers and stuff. And this captain supposedly died 1 year after Clemens adopted the pen name, not before. So there was a captain named Isaiah Sellers. You know, just kind of fit. But the thing is, he didn't want to be associated with Vanity Fair. And by the time that Twain became famous, they were going out of style pretty quick. So in 1873, somebody asked Samuel Clemens, "Hey, where'd you come up with the name?" And they say that he had already patented the Mark Twain scrapbook and had already branded himself Mark Twain. He had signed book deals and established the name, so he didn't want to go back and tell the story about the Vanity Fair. So he took the dead riverboat captain's name. Now, I mentioned at the beginning, the reason all of this didn't come to light for so long was the first biographer, Albert Bigelow Paine, wrote a book in 1912. 3 volumes, Mark Twain, a biography. And he and Clara, Samuel Clemens' daughter, the only surviving heir, they were the only ones who had access to the author's trove of unpublished works, and there was tons. So they went through all of that. Then Clemens had dictated during his final years 450,000 words. But Payne, he wanted to have this legacy, but he did leave some stuff in there. I mean, there are some parts about Samuel Clemens that he did let slip out. Stuff about Satan getting the better of God, stuff about the strain in his family between him and his daughters, stuff not always favoring Samuel Clemens. But scholars began asking whether the public shouldn't be allowed to see these other works kept in the vault, as well as hear more about Clemens' private life. But Payne said no. He said, "I have no desire to parade the things he would wish forgotten." He thought his job was to build a personality so impregnable to criticism that the man we know will remain known as we know him, loved and honored through all time. And the daughter did that, all the way up until she died. And then all hell broke loose. But what happened in the intervening years? Because this was like 60 years in between when that was written and when Clara died. Because she lived to be 88. Could they have gotten rid of more of the angelfish letters? So who was the first? Everybody says, oh, it happened in Bermuda. Well, nope, not really. It started with 15-year-old Gertrude Natkin. And she saw him leaving Carnegie Hall on December 27, 1905, after a matinee song recital. Twain was instantly recognizable, even before he decided to wear only white. He noticed her, to be sure, saw that she wanted to speak to him, introduced himself and shook her hand. The next day she wrote to thank him, "I'm very glad I can go up and speak to you now, as I think we know each other." Describing herself as his obedient child, she ended her note, "I am the little girl who loves you." He responded immediately, calling himself Gertrude's oldest and latest conquest. Their correspondence was playfully flirtatious. He called her his little witch. She called him darling. He sent her a copy of his favorite book, The Writings of a Bewitching Little Scamp Named Marjorie, who had died just short of her 9th birthday in Scotland in 1811. "I have adored Marjorie for 36 years, he confessed in an essay. The child, who confided startling, sophisticated remarks about books and stuff, seemed to him made out of thunderstorms and sunshine. And Gertrude says, may I be your little Marjorie?" That's how Twain addressed her in letters, filled with what the two called blots, or kisses, until 1906, when he got rid of her. Why? Because she turned 16. "I'm almost afraid to send a blot, but I venture it. Bless your heart, it comes with an ace of being improper. Now back you go to 14. Then there's no impropriety." So if she was 16, then it would be improper. But if she was 14, then he can make it seem like it was just a little girl thing. Their correspondence ended when she turned 16. And Twain wanted younger girls. But he loved Gertrude, and he saw that, and he goes, I can find other young admirers. And he found them mostly among his fellow passengers on holiday trips to Bermuda. And like I said earlier, he had collected 10 schoolgirls by 1908, dubbed them angelfish, and awarded them membership in his aquarium club. They had to wear these pins on their left breast above the heart. In 1908, Twain's letters to his angelfish comprised more than half of his correspondence. One letter sent or received every day. Most contained invitations to the girls to visit him in his house. Quote, "I have built this house largely, indeed almost chiefly, for the comfort and accommodation of the aquarium." And he had, like, the rules and regulations of the club. And the lair of the angelfish was his billiard room. And he talked about in his autobiography about how he found his jewels. One morning in Bermuda, as he walked into the breakfast room, "The first object I saw in that spacious and far-reaching place was a little girl seated solitary at a table for two. I bent down over her and patted her cheek and said affectionately and with compassion, 'Why, you dear little rascal, do you have to eat your breakfast all by yourself in this desolate way?' They arranged to meet after breakfast, and he reported we're close comrades, inseparables, in fact, for 8 days. A friend later told him that the 12-year-old girl had asked if he was married, and when learning that he was not, his wife had died, said if I were his wife, I would never leave his side for a moment. I would stay by him and watch him and take care of him all the time. And Twain attributed the remark to the girl's mother instinct and willingly submitted, characterizing himself as a degraded and willing slave. In 1907, on board a ship taking him to England, he found the 16-year-old Frances Nunnally, with whom he said he grew quite confidential, and who became, however briefly, an angelfish. On the return trip, he befriended the 9-year-old Dorothy Quick, who a newspaper reporter noted guarded him closely during the voyage, sitting on his lap with her head leaning against his shoulder. He called her Mon Ami, another reporter wrote, and stood on deck with his arm thrown paternally around the child's shoulder and at one point giving her a fond little hug. Now, apparently, as these reporters reported, his collection of girls was well known. I don't know why in 1912 in the biography they really didn't talk about it, why we had to wait almost 100 years. But because it was known, some adult women pressed for membership. One came for dinner dressed for 12 years and had pink ribbons at the back of her neck and looked about 14 years old. So Twain gave her an angelfish pin because he was impressed. There's lots of lady candidates, he wrote to young angelfish, but I guess we won't let any more in unless perhaps Billy Burke. She was like a comedian who was 23 at the time. And the angelfish, he would invite Burke to dine with the angelfish. But he had met Burke after a performance of My Wife, which is a play whose May December theme fitted his fantasies. And Burke often visited him at his Manhattan townhouse whenever she was working in the Northeast. And while he was collecting his angelfish, he spurned the companionship of his real daughter, Jean, who had been living in medical institutions where her epilepsy could be monitored. In 1909, Jean returned to Twain's home where she drowned in the bathtub. By the time Jean died, Twain's, cavorting with the angelfish had been thwarted by Clara. Clara returned from a European concert tour in 1908 and was appalled by her father's new interest. Why was she appalled? She's the one who put an end to the angelfish's visits. So it kind of disappeared. And then in 1910, just weeks before his death, he found another girl, 15-year-old Helen Allen, who fascinated him. She's bright, smart, alive, energetic, determined, high-tempered, intense. But she was also disappointing, preferring romance literature to poetry and responding to Twain's witticisms and attempts at banter with mute indifference. More disappointing still, she had a boyfriend and Twain was jealous. He cautioned Helen to preserve her innocence. He wanted the younger man out of the way. Now, you could argue that Twain's obsession with these adolescent girls could be explained by his own teenage years, right? Daring and adventure. His wife had nicknamed him Youth. His fictional characters, the most memorable, adolescent Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer. But Twain didn't focus on young boys. He wanted sexually innocent girls from ages 10 to 16, with undeveloped boyish bodies, and with whom he was flirting with. Photos of Twain and his angelfish show them standing or sitting close to him, their bodies touching him, with his arms around their shoulders or waists. They might be his daughters, they might be his lovers. His notes about Helen Allen, the 15-year-old, he wanted to be more than a mentor or grandfather. He hated that he was old. He says, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I feel old and sinful. But at 8 o'clock when I'm shaving, I feel young and ready to hunt trouble, as though I were not over 25 years old. And as I've talked about before, at the London stage at this time was Peter Pan. We talked about Barry in our Was He or Wasn't He? But Mark Twain loved Peter Pan. And he said, there isn't a thing in it which could ever happen in real life. That's as it should be. It's consistently beautiful, sweet, clean, fascinating, satisfying, charming, and impossible from beginning to end. It breaks all the rules of real life drama. He liked Peter Pan. He wanted to be Peter Pan. When Samuel Clemens was 22, he met a 13 or 14-year-old girl named Laura Wright, who he declared an instantly elected sweetheart. Their fleeting encounter had a profound impact on him, and he dreamt of her throughout his life. Now, there is evidence of impropriety with one of the members of the Aquarium Club. In July of 1908, Samuel Clemens wrote to 12-year-old Margaret Blackmer of New York. "I was wondering what was become of you, you dear little angelfish, and was very glad to find out by your letter, which came an hour or two ago. I hoped and believed I should hear from you before very long. My fishes are good and faithful correspondents. There are 12 of them, and 2 days seldom go by without a letter from one or another of them. My house is named Innocence and Home, and it's the angelfishes that are to furnish the innocence. Though the public don't know that, it isn't the public's affair." He was originally going to call that house Autobiography House because he paid for it with royalties from the publication of his autobiography. But he changed the name to account for his new hobby, which he described in an autobiographical dictation of February 12, 1908. "As for me, I collect pets, young girls, girls from 10 to 16 years old, girls who are pretty and sweet and naive and innocent, dear young creatures to whom life is a perfect joy, and to whom it has brought no wounds, no bitterness, and few tears. My collection consists of gems of the first water." And that's when he had just returned from a trip to Bermuda. And he had added Blackmer to the collection that already contained 3. And, I mean, this is what he did. And he put a ton of energy and emotion into the letters that he wrote to the members of the aquarium. He just immersed himself in this artificial world of schoolgirl innocence and adulation. So we know he met Margaret on the first trip. On the second, he discovered Irene Gherkin. And his first interest when he goes to a new place is to find little girls. That's what a reporter said. And off he goes with a flash when he sees a new pair of slim little legs appear. And if the little girl wears butterfly bows or ribbon on the back of her head, then his delirium is complete. He organized this harem. And one of the reasons I think Clara wanted to also fire the secretary was the one who was helping him find them. So maybe that's another reason. Now, there was one of the girls, and the parents were a little bit worried. And that was the Helen Allen person that I've talked about. And maybe the reason that she wasn't into him is because the parents, they were like, Because Clemens was writing these letters. This was right before he died. And then just, you know, his jealousy of Helen's interest in another man, who, by the way, was named Arthur. And Samuel Clemens described him as a man qualifying as neither a groom nor gentleman, but blending both capacities. And, you know, and he talks about a small playmate of Helen's. And that, the author, the Payne, the biographer or whatever, he didn't really know how to do it. And so it's like this final notebook that Payne had seen about Helen or whatever. And he said that it shouldn't be offered for sale or inspection until 50 years after Mark Twain's death. There was also a manuscript which Payne sequestered of notes to and about Helen. Portions of it may well have been written after Payne arrived in Bermuda, because remember, Samuel Clemens was dictating autobiography to him. So, and there was some that were like in code and stuff like that, and they were definitely inappropriate from a 75-year-old man to a 15-year-old. "I think you're very pretty and sweet and dear and cute, Helen. In fact, I know it. I wish I could trade places with Teddy, maybe her toy bear. Who is saccharine? It would be best to tell you in private, Helen." And there was a guy named Albert Lee, who was an employee of Robert Collier, who was in Bermuda, claimed that he knew some story, which is something very terrible that happened in Bermuda shortly before Mark Twain's death. It is something unprintable. So, I mean, what does that mean? But did Clemens' jealousy erupt into some kind of overt thing that frightened or offended Helen's parents? maybe because Ellen was the last one of these 15-year-old surrogates, you know, because that Laura Wright that he had met when he was 22, maybe she got improper comments or even actions. Now, there's a lot of scholars who are opposed to the idea of Mark Twain being a pedophile. Michael Sheldon wrote a biography, and he is very, very much a fan of Mark Twain. And in his book, there's kind of, he talks about the kids, and, but he wanted to make clear that he didn't think anything sexually inappropriate had happened. He goes, while it's no surprise that people have thought that, it bothers me that something pure can be smudged with unfounded suspicion. It's been 100 years. I think we'd have found out by now if he's a pedophile, not if people threw it away. I mean, John Cooley, he went both ways. But one of the things is that he actually wrote Mark Twain's Aquarium, the Samuel Clemens Angelfish correspondence. He had some of the letters and stuff. But he, on page 283 of that book, he says the aquarium gave Clemens great pleasure during a period that was otherwise filled with bitterness and unhappiness. There's no evidence to suggest real impropriety, but we don't know what pain hid or scandal in connection with any of the angelfish. Perhaps his greatest crime was stereotyping and idealizing the lives of these young women. Clemens was probably in love with his memory of himself as a boy or young man. His angelfish behavior was certainly unusual, even obsessive, but it was also the final expression of a lifelong love affair with his teenage years. Now, okay. I mean, Guy Cardwell was a guy who seemed to go that way. And Gore Vidal did this article for the New York Review, Twain on the Grand Tours, in 1996. And Guy Cardwell took offense to some things that Gore said. And says, in the essay entitled Twain on the Grand Tour, Mr. Gore Vidal refers many times to me in one of my books, The Man Who Was Mark Twain. In a number of places, he represents me as having sentiments or beliefs that I do not hold. But what I particularly call to your attention are three passages in which he indicates that I say things which I do not say and which do not appear in the book. Mr. Vidal writes, an academic critic tells us that Clemens was sexually infantile, burnt out at 50, if not before, and giving to pederastic reveries about little girls. And Guy Cardwell said, although the passage summarizes what Clemens and others say about impotence, not what I say, what I question is the phrase given to pederastic reveries about little girls. That Clemens dreamed of little girls is well known. That his dreams and reveries were pederastic is not said in my book by me or by anyone else. And Gore Vidal responded. And he said, although my new pen pal does acknowledge that I'm reporting the views of other critics on Twain's impotence, sexual infantilism, fondness for small girls, he declares mysteriously that this is not what I say. But it is what he says, and presumably means. The Jesuits like to say the wise man never lies. But in the army of my day, any soldier who spent too much time twisting about the language of regulations in his own favor was called a guardhouse lawyer. Straight sentences must be bent like pretzels to change meanings to score points. But then much of what passes for literary discourse in these states is simply hustling words to get them to mean what they don't. That Clemens dreamed of little girls is well known. This quibbler wrote, but now he has second thoughts? Actually, who knows what Twain's dreams were, but let us agree that he doted on the company of girls and so may well have dreamed, fantasized about them in a sexual way. Why not? But Quibbler's getting a bit edgy. He thinks, too, that I have given him a splendid chance to open the guardhouse door. Now we improvise that his dreams and reveries were pederastic as not said in my book by me or by anyone else. But, of course, that's what he and presumably those who he means in the course of the chapter entitled Impotence and Pedophilia. But Quibbler's left at the adjective pederastic. He goes, I'm taking it back from the original root, pedo, pedophilia. Pedo means not boy, but child. As a little final side note, I would like to remind everybody that Jeffrey Epstein went to Mark Twain Junior High. I know. I will talk to you guys.